You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us.
Hi, I'm Annie from the US.
And I'm Johanna from Austria, and you're listening to your favorite international podcast. Before we start, we would love to say thank you to all the absolutely lovely messages we received in response to last week's, well, let's call it something not so good. We got a lot of great input and messages of people understanding exactly what we were talking about, and I will definitely give you some update on what's going on with Jam at the end of this episode.
Mm-hmm. Also, shout out to Astrid. Thank you for all of your help. Also, please listen to the end of this episode if you would like more information about our newest Patreon perk that we're going to try out. It's going to be a monthly live stream for both the murder and mystery tiers. That's in addition to the monthly murder get-together, and we'll talk more about that at the end, because right now it's time to tell you the rest of the life story of Eugène François Vidocq. If you didn't listen to last week's episode, please go back to episode 235. Otherwise, you're going to miss out on just a lot of fun. And if you need, you're going to just miss out. It was a great one. If you need a quick recap, though, Johanna has got your back.
Let's see what we talked about so far. So our journey began in the streets of Arras in France, where Vidocq was born on a fateful night in July of 1775. By the way, this reminds me. So last week I told you how the street he was born in, so the Rue de Miroir de Venise, was renamed to Rue Eugène François Vidocq in honor of him. And I'm honestly a bit confused. Well, the street was renamed to Rue de Trois Visages in 1856. Last week I had used an article I found from 2022 that the street was to be renamed to Rue Vidocq, so Rue Eugène François Vidocq, and that Vidocq herself was supposed to participate in the inauguration, because apparently he played Vidocq in a movie from 2018 titled The Emperor of Paris, but that's beside the point. When I look at the online map of Arras, the street is still named Rue de Trois Visages, so I don't know if they renamed it or not, or if they just put up a plaque or not, or maybe just named part of the street that. I have no idea what's going on. If you are from Arras, or if you are an expert on Vidocq, please let us know. I just wanted to clarify that in case you good people out there are as confused as I am. Anyway, back to Vidocq. So he was born into a wealthy family, but still Vidocq's early years were marked by a mixture of privilege and rebellion. Despite his father's attempts to steer him down the respectable path of life, young Eugène showed an early penchant for trouble, earning him a reputation as a fearless and cunning youth. His nickname was Le Vautrin, which means the boar. He loved fencing and expanded on his skills in a series of duels. Vidocq's teenage years were a whirlwind of excitement and danger. Fueled by a desire for independence, he embarked on a series of daring escapades, including thefts from his own family and a failed attempt to flee to the Americas after stealing quite a big sum of money from his parents.
You're such a shit.
Little punk.
Like, really, if your teenager was up to these shenanigans, come on.
He didn't quite make it to the Americas, though, but he joined the carnival. He was a traveling puppeteer, and he worked with a peddler before returning home. That was before he turned even 16, mind you.
Right.
But it was his time in the military that truly shaped his destiny. Enlisting in the Bourbon Regiment at the age of 16, Vidocq quickly gained a reputation as an expert fencer and a formidable soldier. He was neither, apparently. He fought in 14 duels in the first 6 months of his military service and only won two of them. And I also wouldn't say someone so hot-headed with a tendency to rebel and get thrown into jail is such a formidable soldier after all. So yeah, his rebellious nature and the love for dueling landed him in trouble with his superiors, ultimately leading to his desertion and subsequent involvement in the battles of the First Coalition. I do think he was brave. It's not like he deserted because he was afraid of fighting.
Yeah, that's right. He like went into worse stuff. He was like, you know what? I'm over this. Let's find something worse than this to just see what happens.
I could also see that he was probably a skilled fencer, but his temper and character probably got in his way too often. So despite his valor on the battlefield, Vidocq's military career was rather short-lived. What followed were a series of petty crime arrests and jail sentences, one for beating up a lover and the soldier she had cheated on with. Basically, while in jail, he forged a letter of pardon for another inmate.
Yeah, I think most of us would swap those in terms of which was worse, but you know how it goes back then.
I still think the government, even today, sees crimes against the government as way worse than crimes against other people.
Yes, for sure.
Vidocq wasn't opposed to prison escapes himself. He fled several times, but was found and returned to prison most of the time. So he, whatever. I wanted to say he was an expert escape artist, but then on the other hand, he wasn't that successful. But yeah.
Well, he was good at the first part, just not the second part. Yeah.
The one time he actually made it to Rotterdam, he fell victim to the practice of Shanghaiing by Dutch authorities, which means he was forced into service as a privateer. Vidocq's brief stint at sea ended in another arrest and imprisonment in the notorious Bain de Toulon, where he endured months of hardship and despair. I found it so interesting. Sabine, a member of our Facebook group, said that Vidocq is quite famous in her hometown for escaping the Bain de Brest. That's just one of the bans where he was locked up. I don't think we explained it in detail last week. We talked more about the galleys and such, but a ban refers to a French penal colony or prison, particularly but not just those located in overseas territories. Think Papillon. These penal colonies were known for their very harsh conditions and were often used to incarcerate individuals convicted of serious crimes such as murder, robbery, theft, desertion from the military, and so on. No worries, even those extremely harsh conditions couldn't confine Vidocq's thirst for freedom for long, and he escaped one more time. And that's pretty much where we left off last week, and today we will talk about his miraculous transformation from criminal to detective extraordinaire.
That's right. Don't make fun of my French pronunciation.
Okay, we'll see how this goes. So now we're in the year 1800, and after his escape, Vidocq makes his way to Arras. There, he was met with bittersweet homecoming. His father had passed away while he was gone, leaving behind a grieving family and a void that Vidocq could never fill. Vidocq found himself hiding in his mother's house, grappling with the weight of his past and the uncertainty of his future. However, it wasn't long before he was recognized and threatened to be ratted out to the authorities.
Snitches get stitches.
Mm-hmm. This is something that would happen over and over. He tries to settle down somewhere and be done with crime and just lead a good life. And time and again, he is found out and someone either blackmails or threatens to inform the police on him. I think also his first wife was trying to blackmail him when she heard about his whereabouts. But he didn't give up. He basically just kept going and going and running away. Lots of hiding, really. He was just on the run, mostly. But assuming the identity of an Austrian, Vidocq embarked on a new chapter of his life. He sought to establish himself as a legitimate businessman and to provide a stable life for his mother and his woman friend, a widow he called Annette in his autobiography. Of course, fate had other plans in store. Despite Vidocq's efforts to leave his criminal past behind, his past caught up with him once more. Arrested and brought to prison again, where he learns that he had been sentenced to death in absentia.
You don't want to hear that.
No, that's a bummer. You never want to be surprised with death in absentia. No. Vidocq filed an appeal and awaited a retrial, spending months in prison in anticipation of his fate. As the specter of his impending execution loomed over him, he found himself on the brink of despair. But in the face of adversity, Vidocq made a fateful decision that would alter the course of his life forever. Bum, bum, bum. He, for once, put his trust in the legal system and was sure that he would be forgiven. He just turned himself in and was like, sorry. No, of course not. That was never his MO. Sorry. Hi, sorry. What did happen is, on the 28th of November, 1805, seizing a moment of opportunity, Vidocq escaped from captivity, plunging into the river below the prison. For the next 4 years, he lived as a fugitive, constantly on the run from his past and the authorities.
It's so exhausting. I'm so tired.
Yeah,
I'm tired.
I for sure would have welcomed death in absentia at this point. Like, it sounds great. Just kill me now. I'm so tired. Yeah, so for a while, he just stays in Paris.
Which makes sense. It's a huge city, way easier to disappear there, as opposed to, let's say, Arras, where everyone probably knew him by now.
Exactly right. So you remember that man he had tried to help escape prison with the forged pardon documents way back in the day? Well, while Vidocq was in Paris, he actually witnessed the public execution of this man. So that's awful. And according to his memoirs, this was one of the biggest turning points in his life. He just did not want to end up on the scaffold awaiting his death, which, understandable. But how would he ever turn his life around at this point, right? Back in those days, the idea of once a convict, always a convict was pretty much it. That was the common thought. I mean, that's still what most people think today, right? But at least in a lot of places and countries today, there's some effort in focusing on rehabilitation. But for centuries, people who had made mistakes in their past, gone to jail, and were let go after serving their time, they pretty much had no more chance to lead a lawful life. And this is a huge problem today in America. You know, nobody will employ them. It's hard to find somewhere to live. Everybody knows these stories, and if you don't, you should, because they're happening all around you every day. But Vidocq was in an even worse position because he wasn't just a criminal, he was also a fugitive. He was a convicted fugitive of the law.
Yeah, several times. And don't you find it just as frustrating as I do? He, from birth on, he had every opportunity in life. He was born into privilege that others would never be able to reach. He didn't start his criminal life out of necessity, but maybe some kind of boredom or lust for adventure.
I have some suspected diagnoses for this guy, because, you know, that's my thing and what I used to want to do, but none of them are malicious, you know?
Also, let's cut him some slack. I almost wanted to say that at least he wasn't a violent offender, but then I remembered that he actually was. He beat up his girlfriend and her lover.
I know, but like, I don't like the abuse at all, and I know we say different times all the time, but hitting a woman in 1800 because she cheated on you, would that actually have been looked down on by many?
Yeah, I mean, he was charged for beating up a soldier, which that was a crime, not beating up the woman at all.
Right. Like, he could hit a woman, but not a man. You know what I mean? It was just a different time, I think.
Okay, so he wanted to change his life now. Actually, do we think he really, really wanted to change his life because he thought that he had done so much wrong? Like, did he evolve? Or do we think he just got really tired of living as a fugitive? Because it's tiring, I imagine. And I'm torn on his reasoning here.
Yeah, I think my suspicion with this guy is that he maybe had, like, ADHD or bipolar disorder and was very, very, very smart. And so you just see that like impulsivity and we see the intelligence, you know what I mean? I think he either got older and wiser, because remember, he did all this stuff when he was still a teenager. We're not talking about a 40-year-old man here. We're talking about a teenager. I don't think anything here is malicious, but who can say? I think he just maybe either wised up a little bit and matured, or as his brain started to finish developing, you know? Or he had a scared straight moment when he saw that guy on the scaffold. It's impossible to say.
Probably a lot of factors.
I think that's right. I don't think that he was an inherently bad person. I don't think he was ever an inherently bad person. I just think he made some bad choices sometimes. As a teenager, again, I know that I keep saying this, but teenager.
So what could Vidocq do to switch sides? to once and for all get rid of all the charges, to get rid of the constant threat of prison or worse, even the death sentence. Well, there was a way, and it's one that we are a little bit familiar with. It was a deal. Cut a deal with the authorities. His only chance was to go to the authorities, cut a deal with them, and offer them to be their informant. His chance for redemption in the service of justice, so to say. And he made the decision to change his life forever only days before his 34th birthday. Smells a little bit like midlife crisis to me. Like, where's my life going? What am I even doing?
I know. He didn't even have the opportunity to buy a Jeep or a Corvette. He just had to.
Convertible.
He just had to get his life in order.
Dye his hair. Like, cool tips. Cool guy tips. Frosted.
Love that journey for him.
You'd think that the moment Vidocq walks into the police station or wherever he went with his offer, probably higher up, president of police force maybe, I don't know. Well, you'd think that they would have been laughing their butts off and arrest him on the spot. After all, hey, fugitive, still pending death sentence over here. But surprise, surprise, his offer was accepted and he was incarcerated in Bicêtre, where he began his clandestine work as a spy. He was then transferred to other prisons as well, as a spy and informant, and Vidocq says about this time, quote, "I believe I might have become a perpetual spy. Even the porters and keepers were in ignorance of my mission with which I was entrusted. Adored by the thieves, esteemed by the most determined bandits, for even these hardened wretches have a sentiment which they call esteem, I could always rely on their devotion to me," end quote. But no, Vidocq didn't need to worry he wouldn't be a prison spy forever. After only 21 months, he had paid his debt, so to say, and was released. Well, released is a strong word here. Apparently, they didn't want to risk outing Vidocq to all these criminals, which is pretty considerate in my opinion. And so they made it look like he escaped once more, one last time. Honestly, I know his life as a prison informant was hell of dangerous and could have easily cost him his life several times. But what's 21 months of danger in exchange for getting his life back? He probably would have ended up on the guillotine sooner or later anyway, if he would have kept going like this.
Oh yeah.
But what now? What should he do with the rest of his life? For almost two decades, he knew nothing but petty crime and running from the law. Well, I have to mention one thing I haven't told you yet. Vidocq emerged as a free man in the eyes of the law, somewhat, I'm gonna explain, yet he was shackled by duty to his newfound allegiance. Basically, Vidocq wasn't really free, right? He was still obligated to work for the police as an informant. Also, there was still the sentencing and charge. Well, we're gonna talk about it in a second. Okay, so he would still work for the police as informant, as a complete undercover agent. And that's why the story of him escaping from prison, again, was so brilliant, because who would suspect that he was a snitch? Nobody. That's who. He was so good at his new job, he had connections, he had made himself a name in the criminal underbelly of France a long time ago already, he was a quick thinker, lying and keeping a facade came easy to him, and he not only heard about past crimes, but also about crimes that were in the planning stage. And he even was a participant in a few of these crimes. His talents as an informant did not go unnoticed. The head of police in Paris knew what valuable employee he had on his team. And in 1811, Vidocq was entrusted with a bold new mission: to establish a covert unit tasked with maintaining security and order in the streets of Paris. One Vidocq simply wasn't enough. Paris needed a whole army of Vidocqs, spies, informants, and agents who worked just like Vidocq himself. And the original Vidocq should train them and build the whole unit. Thus, the Brigade de Sûreté, or Security Brigade, was born. A clandestine force comprised of plainclothes agents, handpicked by Vidocq himself. Armed with cunning and guile, Vidocq and his team infiltrated the criminal underworld, posing as fellow criminals to gain the trust of their quarry. I think I mentioned in the beginning of last week's episode that Vidocq is often credited as being the person who came up with the agent provocateur. I'm honestly personally sure this tactic had been used a gazillion times before him, but he was definitely the one who not only mastered it, but who refined and polished it and used it as a regular tactic without any hesitation or ethical or moral doubt.
Yeah. So in essence, an agent provocateur is someone who entices others to commit illegal or incriminating acts, often for the purpose of exposing criminal activity or gathering evidence. Imagine a law enforcement officer who operates on the edge of legality, someone who doesn't just catch criminals but actively lures them into committing illegal acts. This is the essence of the agent provocateur. Here's how it works. Instead of simply observing and apprehending criminals, an agent provocateur actively engages with them, often posing as a fellow criminal or associate. They create situations or opportunities that tempt suspects to commit illegal acts, all while secretly gathering evidence to build a case. Of course, the use of agent provocateurs has also sparked controversy, with concerns about entrapment and ethical boundaries. Nowadays, it's pretty much frowned upon, and rightfully so. Nonetheless, the term remains a fascinating aspect of law enforcement history, embodying the complex and often morally ambiguous nature of undercover work.
I mean, it's frowned upon by us citizens, I'd say. It's not so much frowned upon by most governments and authorities.
Right.
And it's not as if it wouldn't still be used. I remember reading a lot about it when it came to the environmentalist groups and or especially during the G20 protests in 2009. Also, I think it's often used when it comes to human trafficking and terrorism. And while I don't like it when it's done, like, for example, for activist groups that are usually just protesting, when it comes to human trafficking and international terrorism and stuff, I have less of a problem with it in those cases, to be honest. It's an extreme gray area here. I don't know how to express myself without...
I think it's one of those things where if they know or deeply suspect someone is human trafficking or doing some other awful thing, this is how they catch them in the act, great. But you don't ever want to actually see someone who hasn't done anything being led into crime that they wouldn't otherwise have committed had they not been exposed to this person, right? It's why the TV show, like, 24 was so amazing, but also so problematic, because, like, we don't just torture people. Like, that's not okay. Even if it's like, yay, we got the secret. Anyway. So, Vidocq and his team mastered this strategy. They used disguises, personas, and clever schemes to infiltrate criminal networks and gather crucial information. Their success in dismantling criminal enterprises and solving complex cases revolutionized the field of criminal investigation. They were so successful that in December 1813, the brigade received official recognition from Emperor Napoleon I. The whole unit was turned into the Sûreté Nationale. Under Vidocq's leadership, the Sûretés expanded its ranks, recruiting former criminals and ex-convicts who possessed invaluable insight into the minds of their brethren. Vidocq's methods were as unorthodox as they were effective. He personally trained his agents in the art of disguise and subterfuge, orchestrating elaborate stings and undercover operations to ensnare even the most elusive of criminals. This is one of the reasons his memoirs are a pretty entertaining read. Judging from the handful of quotes that we've read, the books are full of tales of deception and intrigue, where every shadow held a potential adversary and every alleyway concealed a hidden threat.
I honestly have them on my list of books to read sometime in the future, which means probably never. So many books, so little time.
Right. It reminded me of the Pinkerton books, too. Like, yeah. These just let me tell you about my exploits as a detective. By 1820, Vidocq's efforts had yielded remarkable results, with crime rates in Paris plummeting under the watchful eye of the Sûreté. Yet, amid the accolades and praise, whispers of controversy swirled around Vidocq, with rumors of entrapment and collusion tarnishing his reputation. And the craziest part of it all, despite his tireless efforts to uphold the law, Vidocq remained a wanted man in the eyes of justice. Officially, he's still a fugitive harboring a past stained by forgery and deception.
So crazy, right? I mean, he's working for years now for the law enforcement.
Yeah.
Doing all this amazing work, and he's like officially still
a wanted, escaped fugitive.
Mm-hmm. Wanted. Yeah. A wanted man.
It's like the A-team. Anyway, Vidocq's fortunes changed when on 26th of March, 1817, he received a pardon from King Louis XVIII, granting him absolution for his past transgressions. He was finally, truly, a free man.
By the way, King Louis XVIII, also called Le Désiré, so the desired, was the Bourbon that followed Napoleon I during the French Restoration. Napoleon was already on the island of St. Helena by 1817 for the final act of his life.
In November 1820, Vidocq embarks on a new chapter of his life with his second marriage. Unfortunately, his second wife is of poor health and dies only 4 years later. Then, only a few weeks after that, Vidocq's mother dies. Her funeral is a big spectacle. She even gets a requiem mass at Notre Dame.
I have two thoughts here. Well, first of all, I wonder what Vidocq's father would have said about all of this. I mean, he died way before his son did turn his life around. He must have been on his deathbed worrying about his black sheep of an offspring.
He would have been very proud of him.
Also, I find it interesting, I think, I don't have proof of that, that's just my opinion here, right? That Vidocq was, like, he was a womanizer, we know that. He was kind of a ladies' man. And he only remarried after he had everything in order, after he had his pardon, after he had, like, this huge, I have the feeling, first of all, he was married to his job as a detective by that time. I think it's unusual that at that time he would stay unmarried for such a long time.
Right.
That's what I'm seeing.
Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah. And so Vidocq's personal losses are compounded by wider political shifts, including the succession of Charles X to the French throne. Under his reign, Vidocq faces friction with new police leadership. The new head of police is a bit more prudish. One of the main complaints is that Vidocq's agents often hang out. This is great. So, one of the main complaints is that Vidocq's agents often hang out in the brothels of the city, mixing with sex workers, and of course they're also drinking while on duty. Vidocq explains time and again that everyone's undercover. They can't work undercover and then pretend they're criminals and then be like, oh, I can't go into a brothel. Jesus is watching. Like, that's not going to fly, right? And so this goes on until finally Vidocq has had enough and he takes decisive stand and he tenders his resignation in June 1827. His departure marks the end of an illustrious 18-year tenure with the police force, characterized by his relentless pursuit of justice and unyielding dedication to his craft. So he's pissed. Like, he's mad about it.
Understandably so. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
He's doing the work. Like, he's successful at what he's doing. It's working. It's not like they're just, you know,
that's right,
getting drunk, having sex in brothels and not showing anything for it.
Exactly.
They are successful.
That's right. And so now we would like to read to you his letter of resignation. He is salty. Quote, "For 18 years, I served the police with distinction. I've never received any criticism from your predecessors. I must think, therefore, that I never earned any. Since your appointment to the 2nd Division, this is the second time you did me the honor to address me by complaining about my agents. Am I their master in the time they spend out of office? No. To save you, sir, the trouble of sending me further similar complaints in the future, and me the inconvenience of receiving them, I have the honor to solicit you for accepting my resignation." End quote.
That's not quiet quitting?
No.
That's not that.
No, this is not that.
But you don't have to worry about Vidocq. By the time he resigned, he was a made man. Not only had he been able to amass quite a fortune, apparently he owned 500,000 francs at the time of his retirement. And if I got that right, and you know how hard it is sometimes with different currencies and in the inflation calculator, that would be around $2.5 million today. I think that's quite nice.
Yeah, that's stable money. You don't just have a horse.
Pretty much.
Yeah, you can have your own stable. You could even have a carpet in the stable. Solid.
He also started to work on his memoirs with the help of a ghostwriter, and those books were a huge success internationally. So now he's a wealthy man, and he ventured into the world of business. In the small town of Saumandy, east of Paris, Widock founded a paper factory, marrying his cousin Fleuride along the way. Widock's factory employed a workforce comprised largely of released convicts, a decision that, again, stirred up scandal and controversy in society. People were just not happy that he would do that. Despite facing opposition and disputes, Widock's factory operated for a brief period before ultimately succumbing to bankruptcy in 1831. Meanwhile, political upheavals rocked France once more, with the July Revolution of 1830 forcing King Charles X to abdicate. And amidst the chaos, Widock's expertise in crime-solving caught the attention of the new police prefect, who reinstated him as chief of the Sûreté. However, Widock's methods faced increasing scrutiny and criticism. Allegations surfaced regarding his involvement in orchestrating a theft to demonstrate his indispensability, leading to internal conflict within the police force. I can see him doing things like that, like staging things like that. I don't put it behind him. His agents were also said to be not of the squeamish kind when it came to, I call it police brutality, which is not really the correct term because they were not really police officers, but they were kind of an arm of authorities.
Right.
Apparently, they were so brutal that their behavior towards rioters was even too much for regular police officers.
Mm.
Can you imagine back in those days, nobody thought twice about a member of the authorities using physical force? Definitely. But they were acting too brutal even for the time. I mean, let's not sugarcoat it. Many of Widock's agents were former convicts. After all, brutality was a normal part of their life for some of them. And how do you say tigers don't change their stripes? And now that I think about that, I wonder, how did they choose their agents? For sure no murderers, but I'm not sure that they wouldn't hire some violent offenders.
Yeah, so I actually read about this. Former convicts seeking employment with Widock typically underwent a rigorous screening process. Their criminal backgrounds were assessed, and they did not exclude violent offenders from consideration, but Widock prioritized individuals who showed real remorse for past actions and a willingness to reform. You know what I mean? He tried to hire people who seemed sincere. Of course, yeah. He was aware of the risks involved in hiring individuals with criminal histories, but he believed in giving people a second chance, and he really saw potential where others only saw a criminal past, believing that reformed criminals could be valuable assets in combating crime. Widock's approach to recruitment was not without controversy, as critics questioned the reliability of agents with criminal backgrounds. However, he defended his choices, arguing that those who had experienced life on the wrong side of the law were often best equipped to navigate its complexities.
Which makes absolute sense. And I like that he was willing to give the second chance in life that he had received also to others. Like, he was not a hypocrite when it came to that. Do we think that maybe the whole they were too brutal to rioters and stuff was like exaggerated to shine a bad light on them because they already wanted to get rid of him and his people?
It's possible. It's possible. It's hard to know, though, isn't it, really? I just appreciate the fact that he gave other people the benefit of the doubt, right? Like, nobody wants to be judged forever by our behavior on our worst day. And imagine your worst day was something that landed you in prison.
I mean, there's always lines, like, if your worst day is being Ted Bundy, then but I know that's not what you mean. I just want to make it clear for
No. Yeah. If you're out there intentionally hurting people, forget about it. Spend the rest of your life in prison. But when you are not a threat to society in any way, anyhow, yeah, I hate that we have to make that clear, but yeah, obviously. So anyhow, as tensions simmered in society, Vidocq's position became just untenable. Rivalries developed and doubts arose regarding the credibility of his organization's eyewitness accounts.
given the criminal background of many of his agents. Faced with mounting challenges and his third wife's illness, Vidocq resigned once again on November 15, 1832, marking the end of his tenure as chief of the Sûreté.
After this, Vidocq ventured into kind of uncharted territory as he founded Le Bureau de Renseignement, the Bureau of Information, in 1833. And this is the birth of the first known detective agency, blending elements of sleuthing with a kind of private police force. Vidocq, undeterred by societal norms, once again assembled a team predominantly composed of ex-convicts. With 11 detectives, 2 clerks, and 1 secretary, his squad embarked on a mission to combat fraudsters, crooks, and the bankruptcy artists plaguing the streets of Paris. But as Vidocq's agency gained momentum, so did the controversy surrounding his methods. In 1837, tensions reached a boiling point when the police executed a search and seizure of his office, uncovering over 3,500 files and documents. There were accusations of deception, corruption, landing Vidocq behind bars once more. I would love to tell you that this was his last time in prison, but I can't. It wasn't. I think if he were alive today, Vidocq would be great as the host of one of these shows where people show different prisons. What's the show called? Inside World's Toughest Prisons?
Oh yeah, he'd be perfect for that.
You know which one I'm talking about?
I do. He'd have his own show immediately.
Yeah. He was charismatic enough to be on TV, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think, from what we read.
Yeah.
So, Vidocq was facing very serious charges, but he could emerge victoriously from the legal battle with the judge dismissing all accusations against him. Yet, the damage to his reputation and business was irreparable. Business at the agency suffered, and attempts by powerful adversaries to expel him from the city further tarnished his name. In 1842, another blow struck as Vidocq found himself imprisoned once more, facing accusations of illegal arrest and embezzlement. It's not getting any better. Although he ultimately secured his freedom through political intervention, he had friends in the right places already at that time. Didn't help too much because the whole ordeal took a toll on his finances and, again, his standing in society. Like, his name was burned. Vidocq sought to set the record straight, publishing several books to refute the rumors circulating about him. However, tragedy struck again in 1847 with the passing of his beloved third wife, Fleurite. Then the winds of change swept through France once more in 1848. Well, it swept through whole Europe in 1848, ushering in the February Revolution and the dawn of the Second Republic. And he was always very happy to be tied to the Bourbon king after the French Revolution, King Louis XVIII. Despite his previous ties to this monarchy, Vidocq offered his services to the new government, and he was tasked with surveilling political opponents in this, again, climate of chaos and absolute violence. And one of these people he was tasked with surveilling was Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte, which was the nephew of Napoleon I. What can I say? Vidocq had put his money on the wrong horse, apparently, because the man he was supposed to surveil, he actually won. It was a landslide win. Napoleon III served as the president of France from 1848 to 1852, and later, much like his uncle, became emperor of the French people from 1852 until 1870. He was the first president of France to be elected by popular vote and was instrumental to the transformation of France from a republic back to an empire.
Of course, Vidocq was never shy to seize an opportunity, and so he wrote to the new president offering his service, but Napoleon III never responded.
Which, I can see why.
I mean, yeah. And that leads us to the final years of Vidocq's life. As colorful and adventurous as his life had been, his golden years were pretty modest. In 1849, Vidocq found himself behind bars, once more, one last time, facing a charge of fraud. However, this case was eventually dropped, marking his last brush with the law. As the years passed, Vidocq retreated from public life, taking on only occasional small cases, but his final years were marred by health issues.
including persistent pain in his right arm from an old, improperly healed injury, and financial setbacks due to unwise investments. In August 1854, he defied a grim prognosis by surviving a bout of cholera. That is a bummer.
Sorry, I'm like, oh man, cholera.
But by April 1857, his health had deteriorated significantly, leaving him bedridden. On May 11th, 1857, at the age of 81, Vidocq passed away in his home in Paris, surrounded by his doctor, lawyer, and priest. I mean, who else do you need? That's the Holy Triumvirate.
It's kind of sad, though, no? There was no family, no, I don't know.
I would have thought there would have been more illegitimate children.
I mean, I'm convinced there were, a lot, and a lot who claimed to be. Well, we know of one,
yeah.
But we'll get into that. Yeah. But they wouldn't be there when he's on his deathbed.
No.
They would come afterwards, probably.
No. Yeah. It's sad. But he had his... He wasn't alone. I mean, they say everybody dies alone, no matter how many people are with you.
I also think, I mean, he led a life where... I mean, he led a dangerous life. He made a lot of
enemies.
Brutal enemies.
Yeah.
In the criminal world and in the political world.
Yes. Maybe that's why he didn't marry. I mean, maybe he just didn't feel like it was safe.
Yeah, maybe.
Reflecting on his legacy, the poet Alphonse de Lamartine remarked, quote, "I liked him. I appreciated him. I will never forget him. And I can just say he was an honest man," end quote. That's a pretty great way to be remembered.
Yeah, I think so too.
Vidocq's funeral service was held at the Church of Saint-Denis du Saint-Sacrement. However, the exact location of his burial remains a mystery, with rumors suggesting various sites. Some claim his grave lies in the cemetery of Saint-Mandé, while others dispute this, citing conflicting information. So we don't know where his bones are.
Yeah.
In his final will, Vidocq left behind a modest sum of money from the sale of his belongings and a pension. A total of 11 women came forward, each claiming ownership of his testament, which they received as tokens of his affection.
If the testaments were really given by Vidocq, I can really picture that man, who was such a womanizer till the end, handing out wills left and right, knowing full well that they would all fight about it when
right.
he was gone. But I mean, that wasn't his problem
yeah.
in the end.
There's £2 and half a bottle of brandy and one very angry old cat that needs insulin injections. Who wants it? Right? All right. Ultimately, his remaining assets went to the woman who had taken care of him in his later years. There were, however, attempts by Emile Adolphe Vidocq, the son of his first wife, to claim recognition as his heir, but he was unsuccessful. There was enough evidence disproving his paternity, including Vidocq's incarceration during the time of his conception. So that's a problem. If the guy was in jail when you were conceived, then...
I mean, we know that Bars couldn't hold him back for a
while. Well, I was just going to say, having said that now, what were the, did they have any conjugal visitation rights back then?
I don't think so.
I don't know. French prison.
Okay, so now we heard a lot about this absolute gray area of a man. Not everything he did was right or good or kind, but we absolutely can't deny the impact he had on law enforcement and criminology. Vidocq's pioneering work did not only consist of his undercover operations and new tactics being used, he also contributed to advancements in forensic science. He, for example, introduced the concept of ballistics and record-keeping systems to criminal investigations. His meticulous approach to crime scene investigations and identification of criminals set absolutely new standards in law enforcement. Apparently, Vidocq praised himself of having a photographic memory. He said he would never forget a face and would be able to recognize it even in disguise. Something I can only dream of. I can't remember faces and names, which is the worst combination possible, trust me. To be fair, though, Vidocq kept training his abilities. Like, he made frequent visits to prisons to memorize the faces of inmates, a practice he also instilled in his agents. And this meticulous approach became an absolute cornerstone of criminal identifications, influencing law enforcement agencies, not only in France, but internationally. Of course, Vidocq was well aware that not all of his agents had such an excellent memory, so he came up with an index card system for each arrested individual. These cards contained detailed personal descriptions, previous convictions, and their modus operandi, among other crucial information. However, as time passed, the index card system revealed its weakness, and by the late 19th century, the descriptions on the cards became insufficient for absolute accurate identification, and it was during this period that Alphonse Bertillon, we all know the name, introduced the Bertillonage, an anthropometric system for personal identification. I don't know if you've ever seen this card, but the method utilized body dimensions, like they measure from fingertips to fingertips when the convict stretches the hand out, mm-hmm. like in a Jesus on the cross position, things like this. Like, there is a lot of data that's on this card. It also marked a transition from manually sorting to more sophisticated techniques. The more information you have on the cards, the more of a sophisticated system you need. And then, obviously, with the onset of the information age, the traditional index cards were digitalized, giving rise to databases that streamlined the process of criminal identification up until the system we have today. But it all started with Vidocq. And that's fascinating, in my opinion. And that's not all. Vidocq demonstrated a keen interest in experimental methods, setting up a small laboratory in his office building where he conducted absolutely pioneering investigations. His superiors may have been hesitant to embrace scientific advancements. Vidocq was undeterred, utilizing innovative techniques to solve cases long before they gained mainstream recognition. One area where Vidocq made significant contributions was in the development of chemical compounds to combat forgery. That's an area of expertise he absolutely had. In 1817, he commissioned two chemists to create a tamper-proof paper that was treated with chemicals that would react if later amended, thus thwarting counterfeiters. This groundbreaking paper, for which Vidocq actually filed a patent, became widely adopted, particularly among bankers seeking to safeguard against financial fraud, and Vidocq's ingenuity extended to the creation of indelible ink utilized by the French government for printing banknotes, which again further enhanced security measures when it came to paper currency. Again, fascinating.
It is, yeah.
Vidocq's expertise also extended to ballistics, as illustrated by his involvement in a murder case documented actually by Alexandre Dumas, when a woman was tragically shot dead and the suspicion fell upon her husband, the Comte d'Arcy. However, Vidocq's meticulous examination of the evidence, including the recovered bullet and firearms, revealed discrepancies that ultimately implicated the woman's lover. And this early demonstration of forensic ballistics laid the groundwork for future advancements in criminal investigation techniques. While forensic science would evolve considerably in the years following Vidocq's tenure, his pioneering efforts laid the absolute foundation for modern investigative practices, and his relentless pursuit of justice and innovative approaches continue to inspire generations of law enforcement professionals around the world. And today, Vidocq still impacts lives through organizations like the Vidocq Society. I think they were founded in the 1990s in, I want to say, Pittsburgh or Philadelphia. They are dedicated to solving cold cases, and they are upholding the pursuit of truth and justice.
I love that. So we thought it would be fun to end this episode with some interesting facts about Vidocq. Before he turned his life around during his years in and out of prison, Vidocq learned the art of pugilism, which was a form of bare-knuckle boxing popular at this time. Pugilism involved striking and grappling techniques. It was like boxing, bare-knuckle boxing, and wrestling, sort of. And it emphasized skill and agility and endurance. It was a really brutal sport, often fought with no protective gear, no gloves, as we said, and bouts could last for round after round until one fighter was knocked out or conceded defeat.
Vidocq's proficiency in pugilism likely contributed to his physical prowess and ability to defend himself in the rough world of law enforcement and criminal investigation.
Yeah, that would come in handy for sure. I also think I read that he was a rather tall and strong man. Like, he was impressive.
Vidocq was also close friend of renowned French author Honoré de Balzac. In America, we say Balzac, so I gotta get used to this pronunciation. Okay. Their friendship began in 1822, and Balzac used Vidocq as a model for several characters in his literary works. Balzac was fascinated by Vidocq's colorful life and character and incorporated elements of his experiences into his novels, contributing to the popular image of Vidocq as a legendary figure in French literature. One of the most notable characters inspired by Vidocq is Vautrin, also known as Jacques Collant in Lost Illusions. Vautrin is a complex and intriguing character who shares some similarities with Vidocq in terms of his past as a convict turned influential figure.
Also, Vautrin was his nickname in his youth, so you can also see the kind of influence there.
Definitely.
But that's not the only time that Vidocq was the inspiration for a famous author. Victor Hugo modeled not just one, but two characters after Vidocq in the same book. Protagonist and antagonist. In Hugo's novel Les Misérables, the character of Jean Valjean, the protagonist, is often associated with Vidocq. Like Vidocq, Valjean is a former convict who seeks redemption and ultimately becomes a respected member of society, paralleling some aspects of Vidocq's own life journey. While Jean Valjean is not a direct portrayal of Vidocq, the themes of redemption, justice, and the complexities of human nature that Hugo explores in Les Misérables resonate with Vidocq's experience and character. And then we have the antagonist, Inspector Javert, the relentless police inspector in the same novel. He's also believed to have been inspired by Vidocq. Javert's unwavering commitment to enforcing the law and his dogged pursuit of Jean Valjean, even in the face of moral ambiguity, echo aspects of Vidocq's career in law enforcement. While Javert represents the rigid adherence to authority and the pursuit of justice without mercy, Jean Valjean embodies redemption and the capacity for change, creating a dynamic contrast that absolutely reflects the complexities of Vidocq's own life and legacy. Maybe they were like just even two sides of his personality fighting each other in there.
That's right. And stay tuned, because after this episode, I will of course be performing the musical Les Misérables in its entirety. I'm kidding, probably. All right, so... Apparently, also Mark Twain was absolutely fascinated by Vidocq and his memoirs. There are movies, graphic novels, and novels that heavily draw from Vidocq's life. And to this day, people are fascinated by this tale of redemption. And I think we can all agree that Vidocq is an absolute testament that it is truly never too late to turn your life around and to just keep going in the right direction, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. I love this. Redemption always makes a great story, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think it's also an example of how much a person can achieve if they find their true passion in life. Like, I think Vidocq was kind of aimless and bored when he was young, which led him down the wrong path, but he became an insanely hard worker and insanely successful once he found what he was really good at. And I don't mean the crime part, I mean the detective part.
Totally agree.
Also, our listener Doug wrote us a message and he mentioned the movie Vidocq starring Gérard Depardieu. Doug, I'm excited to inform you that I indeed did watch the movie back when it came out, which was over 2 decades ago. And I have to be honest, I don't remember a lot, just that the plot was really confusing, but that the movie looked gorgeous, like from a visual viewpoint. Also, back then, I had absolutely no idea who Vidocq even was. I was like, what's even going on in this movie? Which probably didn't matter too much because it wasn't a biopic or something. Mm. It was a lot of fantasy elements, as far as I remember. Kind of steampunky, I want to say. But I would be interested to rewatch it to see what I think of it now. And I also want to watch the movie with Vincent Cassel. You know what, Annie? I really don't understand why nobody's working on a really, really good... Like, I know there was a TV show about Vidocq, a French TV show in the 90s, I want to say, or 80s. But, like, nowadays TV shows, even international TV shows, are, like, top-notch. Like, that's next-level entertainment. And I don't know, his story has everything you need for an interesting and compelling TV show. Like, what's going on? Netflix, Apple, Amazon? I don't know, Hulu, HBO, come on, someone, do something. It should be a French production, but like, I think Netflix does a lot of good work with international productions.
They do. I really didn't know much about him at all before this episode, and I absolutely agree. It would make a fantastic series and a long one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much we didn't cover.
So much. Yeah.
But maybe some of you out there got inspired and want to look deeper and read the books. Or there are many books about him. So there's a lot of information out there.
Yeah. All right.
Do you have something good?
It's been a week. It's been a really tough couple of weeks. And like we said previously, thank you for the very nice messages. My something good is, despite kind of a rough few weeks, I was able to get out with my dear friend Tam and see... We went to see the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
It's with...
Henry Cavill and...
Yeah, Henry Cavill, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's Guy Ritchie film.
Yeah. Was it good?
Alan Ritchson. I enjoyed it very much.
It's set in the Second World War, as far as I remember,
That's right. And it's based on a true story. I'm not going to lie, Tam and I went for the eye candy, and we're not disappointed.
Yeah.
I would have liked to see more rowing. It's fine. It was great. And then just recently, Paul and I were able to get out and go see Hadestown. We just went to see it. And it was wonderful. It's in Boston at the Wang Theater, which is called something different, but it'll forever be the Wang. It's on till the 28th. So if you have a chance to go and see it, I would recommend it. Yeah, it's beautiful.
My something good is, so for all of you who listened last week's the problems with Gem, I told you that I'm going to have an appointment with the orthopedic vet, which we did have on Monday. You know, that my biggest fear is obviously that there's something in his brain, like a tumor or something growing or something putting pressure on his brain. But the vet said that in his opinion, oh, he was so nice. He was like, all the vets I ever encountered are nice, but he was like next level and very calm and very experienced doing it for a long time. And he said, in his opinion, and he obviously can't say it for sure without looking at an MRI, but in his opinion, it's from the spine, like from the neck shoulder region, mm-hmm. that something is putting pressure there. And it's not that advanced yet. He said that we should give the Gallibrand for another 2 weeks. The problem is that the Gallibrand seems to help Cem,
mm-hmm.
but you can't give it for too long because it affects the kidneys. So that's the downside.
Gotcha.
So we just can give it for another 2 weeks. And I don't think that it's going to be done afterwards. It's not like, oh, it's going to calm down.
Mm.
The kind of inflammation will go down. And I think the problems will come back stronger. And then the vet said, well, if that happens, then we need to do an MRI and check. And worst case scenario is that he's going to have like a surgery on his spine. But that's like far, far ahead.
Yeah.
Because there is no signs that he has like... so much pain and this kind of stuff.
Good.
But we really had to look at the MRI to see what's going on there. But in his opinion, there shouldn't be anything in his brain. Like all the tests he did.
Okay, good. Good.
Indicate that it's the spine.
Good. Yeah. Okay.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want, like the brain is kind of the worst case
100%.
Scenario for me.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
They can see like kind of a little bit of spondylosis in his shoulder region, but he said it's so minor that he can't say for sure that that's what's causing the problem.
Ah, right. All right. Well, fingers crossed we keep going in the right direction and...
Yeah.
No.
I'm gonna keep you updated.
Please do.
So, not the best, but it's definitely good.
Yeah. We're gonna try something new this month and bear with us as we figure out sort of what we're doing. As we said initially when we began the Patreon, We don't ever want to put stuff behind a paywall that would be part of our regular show. We don't want, like, extra episodes, things like that. It's just, I don't know, we want our show to be totally accessible to everybody, whether or not they can afford to actually support the show financially. So it's been a struggle trying to figure out what to do. So this is a new thing. We're going to see how it goes. It'll probably, you know, morph into what it'll eventually become as we go. But we're just going to do like a monthly roundup where we're going to talk about some of the big headlines of the month, especially in true crime, but also just world headlines, no politics, because we listen to podcasts to get away from reality, right? Let's just, no politics, but just a chat, just like a monthly catch-up, roundup chat that will be available to our murder and mystery patrons. And so look in the Patreon feed. There will be a post about it, and you can post ideas that you would like us to discuss. You can, if you're not going to be available for the live show, if you have any thoughts or comments that you want to share with us, let us know right in that feed, and we'll include them and our thoughts about your thoughts when we do this thing. Does that make sense?
Exactly. You will be able to rewatch it again, just like with the Murder Tier get together. It's going to be on 29th of April, and the Murder Tier get together, we still haven't decided on a date because we asked our patrons when would be best for them, but it will be somewhere beginning of May, and this time we're going to be talking about O.J. Simpson.
That's right.
Everything that happened there.
That's right.
So, that's going to be interesting.
Yes, it is.
Other ways to support our podcast that only cost you a couple of minutes of your time, please do us the favor, write us a rating and or review on your podcast app, leave us comments under our YouTube videos, under our Spotify episodes, recommend us to friends, family, colleagues, in social media groups that ask for recommendations for this kind of true crime that is more on the history side of events. And that's it. Send us messages. We love them. It's very helpful, very supportive. We always enjoy hearing from you.
Yes, we do.
Check out our webpage, freshhellpodcast.com. There you'll find all the links to our email address, which is freshhellpodcast@gmail.com, to our merch store, to our Patreon, to our Facebook group, which is the loveliest group of little weirdos out there in the world.
It's the best.
That's it. Please tell your pets. We said hi, hug them, cuddle them, kiss them, give them treats, take them to the vet. Be kind to them. Be kind to your fellow human being. Take a little bit of an example from VDOC, maybe. Give them a second chance if they deserve it. Not automatically. They have to deserve it.
That's right.
And the hardest part of it all is be kind to yourself.
That's right. And remember, if you're going through hell,
keep going. Tschüss.
Bye.